Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hear my words and bear witness to my vow. Night gathers and now my watch begins. It shall not end until my death. I shall take no wife, hold no lands, father no children. I shall wear no crowns and win no glory. I shall live and die at my post. I am the sword in the darkness. I am the watcher on the walls. I am the shield that guards the realm of men. I pledge my life and honor to the Night's Watch. For this night, and all the nights to come.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching Game of Thrones. I'm Vanity Fair Senior Writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair Chief Critic Richard Lawson.
If you're just joining us, we are counting down our top 15 episodes of Game of Thrones. I think we are like one third, one quarter of the way through. I don't know. We're on our way. We are in season four. This week we are talking about season four, episode one, Two Swords, written by Weiss and Benioff and directed by D.B. Weiss. Dan Weiss is going to be co-directing the finale with David Benioff. I think they actually like technically co-directed this, but because of like some rules in the DGA or something like that, it's credited to Weiss, but I think this is a co-pro between Weiss and Benioff in actuality. Here is my 15-word recap of this episode. The Hound needs some chicken, Tywin makes some swords, and Jaime gets a new hand. So, it certainly doesn't cover all of it, but it covers some of it. There are two main reasons why I wanted to talk about this episode. One is that it's got, I think, one of the classic cold openings of Game of Thrones, which is the melting down of Ned Stark's sword into two new Valyrian steel swords. There are very few cold openings in Game of Thrones, and this is one of them. And then it is the introduction of Oberyn Martell. So I'm going to kick off. We're going to talk generally about why this episode's important. We're here in here we are, season four. We've survived the Red Wedding. Here we go. There are many reasons why this episode's important. We're going to hand out some awards before we get there, but I think we're going to start with the obvious MVP of the episode, which is Pedro Pascal, who blasts onto the scene as Oberyn Martell. Richard, do you have a different obvious MVP for this episode?
No, of course not.
Yeah.
Like, that's the one. Well, it's just so funny because, so, you know, we're starting this new season. The Stark war is over. Some of the Starks are still obviously a big part of the show, but like that whole plot line is kind of done. And so the show needs to introduce something new. And here comes this like totally different energy than we've had on the show before. And I think it's a big task that Pascal handles pretty well.
Yeah. I mean, like you're immediately there. Here's this infusion of not only a new character, but like, a new kind of character, right? Like, we haven't had any Dorne in the show yet. So, like, here's all of Dorne. I mean, that went south eventually, but, like, started really strong. You know, shout out to Adira Varma, too, who's great, as Ilaria Sand. She's fantastic. But we meet You know, Oberyn, Ilaria, your boy Oliver, all in the brothel, and you're immediately, like, sort of taken by them. It's funny, because I remember, this is when you and I both actually first started writing for Vanity Fair, this is our first season of Game of Thrones that we ever wrote about for Vanity Fair. And I remember, because I was a book reader, when they released the photos, I think, from the premiere, I wrote a whole piece that was like, here are two characters you're going to love. Here's Oberyn Martell and Ilaria Sand, you don't know who they are, but you're going to love them. And I felt so confident as a book reader. And I was right. And then I think I did the same thing with Aegis Sandgate. I was like, Sand Snakes. I was like, here's three more characters you're definitely going to love. And then, like...
And everyone loves them, and they're the most popular characters from the show.
The end. All right. So, Pedro Pascal, obvious MVP. My sneaky MVP for this episode. Actually, and this is something we haven't talked about that much, but I really, really love the season four work from Sophie Turner. As Sansa Stark. We watch Sansa deal with the aftermath of the Red Wedding in this episode. She's got this lovely scene with Tyrion where she's like upset, but there's something different than the sort of childlike upset that we see from her in season three. Where this is just a profound wound. It's deeper than the wound from her father's death even. And it's just like, maybe because she felt more connected to her mother, or I don't know what it was, but it's just sort of like, her family's dead. I think it's that Ned died, but her family was still sort of like holding down the fort in the north. And if she could just get out of King's Landing, like she could be safe at home. But when her mother and her brother die, she has no idea where Arya is or if Arya is alive. Jon was never anything to her. Bran and Rickon are dead as far as she's concerned. Like, she's alone in the world now. That's how she feels. And I think you begin to see, like, Sansa Stark as Lady of Winterfell is such, like, a frosty human. And she has many good reasons to be a frosty human. And you start to see young Sophie Turner, like, go there in this episode. So that's why she's my sneaky MVP.
That's a good choice. I think that, my choice was more just gonna be like silly, but it's like Maester Aemon again, because yeah. I love in the little, trial scene where he's like, if every, you know, Night's Watchman, we'd be headed for sleeping with a girl, there would be, the wall would be empty. You know, it's like just very like practical. Like he's just like, he's like takes his job seriously, but also is like realistic about the world. So, I always like him when he's in the episode.
There's no bad Maester Aemon scene. Like,
no, exactly.
Never. He's fantastic from start to finish. Absolutely. All right. here's the time when we perform a quote from the episode. This is the first time where I feel confident because I know I can do a Martell impression. And it goes like this. Do you know why all the world hates a Lannister? that's my Oberyn Martell impression.
That's good.
What do you got, Richard?
My quote is, Thins. I fucking hate Thins. Because who likes the Thins? Nobody likes the Thins.
Nobody likes the Thins. That's so great. Yeah, we get some cannibalism in this episode, which is really fun. All right, we are going to do Best Dressed, and I hate to be redundant, but I cannot give it to anyone else but, you know, the shiny prince himself, Oberyn Martell, and his, like, silky saffron robe. He wears many beautiful robes in this season, but this is our first one, and it is a doozy. What do you say?
I like Olivar's little blue number.
Yeah, it's pretty good. It's pretty good. And to round out my redundancy, my ship for this episode is Oberyn Martell in literally anything with a pulse. He shows in this episode that he is game for it. He is pansexual. He is, into it all. This is the most sexually liberated couple in all of, Game of Thrones. What do you say, Richard?
I mean, it's hard to argue with that, but, I could say maybe also, you know, Tormund and the Thins, you know, like.
Sure.
Build bridges.
Build bridges with your sexuality. I mean, there's, like, good stuff with, Indira Varma also.
Oh, she's wonderful. And there's New Dario.
New Dario. Michelle Huseman. His introduction in this episode is so funny because, like, they recast Dario between season 3 and season 4, because I believe it's because Ed Skrein wanted to do The Transporter, because he thought The Transporter would be the beginning of a beautiful franchise for him. he's doing great stuff, by the way. Like, I actually really liked him in Alita Battle Angel, a movie that I didn't enjoy, and I think he's great in Deadpool as well. So, he's doing some good stuff.
He also, did a good thing where he was cast in a role that was meant for an Asian actor, and he stepped down.
Yeah. So, we're pretty up on Ed, but he might have made a bad decision leaving this show. Anyway, when new Dario rolls up, we get this whole scene where Daenerys goes, "Where's Dario?" And they're like, "He's over there with Grey Worm." So whoever we find over there with Grey Worm,
that's who he is.
Definitely Dario.
No questioning that. Yes, we did have the one Lannister or Baratheon boy play his cousin, but no tricks here.
It's fine. This is fine. So yeah, it's we get new Dario, we get some great Olivar stuff, and we're off to the races. This is a King's Landing heavy episode, but we get some other stuff. I mean, we get a classic Arya and the Hound scene. Arya and the Hound hook up at the end of season 3, but this is the beginning of a season long road trip sort of, sequence for them, and the really beginning of Arya, like Sansa, really leaning into her darkness after what she saw at the twins. And so we get the Hound and Arya at this tavern, and Arya kills a guy with her sword that she gets back from him. And it's like vengeance for her friend that he killed, but it's very dark, this scene here.
Well, yeah, because she kills two people, and the first one she kills with a bigger sword, and she just very slowly, probably because it's a big, heavy sword and she's tiny, just slowly pushes it into the guy's chest, which is, horrifying. And then with Needle, obviously, she stabs him through the neck. And it's interesting, I think we were talking on another episode about Daenerys and the sort of birth of her sort of sociopathy, for lack of a less dramatic word. Yeah. And I think that the interesting thing about this show that always I kind of questioned, is Arya, and maybe in the books too, is Arya supposed to be a hero? Are we rooting for her? Is she cool? Is she whatever? And of course she has her moments, but ultimately this is a story about a kid who, yes, was interested in sword fighting like her brothers, whatever, but this is a story about a kid who is completely radicalized by war and tragedy into becoming a straight up murderer. And I think the show has always been at least a little bit careful to mourn that a little bit rather than just being look, she got tough,
Yeah. I mean, my hope for Arya is there's some sort of healing journey for her in the final season.
Yeah.
Because yeah, this is the dark path she's on. I think it's easy to cheer for her sometimes, 'cause you're just you take your revenge, little girl with a sword. You're so cool. But then, when you stop to think about it, as you say, everything about her is deeply tragic. This is a person who's profoundly broken by the things that have happened to her family. And, all of her quote-unquote badassery is just, frantic survival tactics, And you see that a lot, I think, in season 7 when she comes back to Winterfell and she's so creepy and her sister doesn't know what to do with her,
Yeah.
Arya being weird and doing faithless man shit over in Braavos is one thing. Arya coming home and planting that stuff in Winterfell really underlines how strange a turn her life took, so.
And here is the kind of beginning of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And then we get one of my favorite interactions, which is Lady Olenna and Bran of Tarth, where Lady Olenna says something "You're magnificent."
Oh God, she loves her so yeah, much. It's
she
the best.
Loves her.
Because you think that she's going to be who is this beast or whatever? But instead she's like, oh, you're fabulous. I love you.
Yeah. You're amazing. Incredible.
Yes.
Yes. Queen. Yes, Brienne. Yeah. And we get, the Brienne and Margaery stuff. Once again, it's like you've mentioned in the past, the show not forgetting its connections, that Renly connects these two women, that is a thing, that these women have a history together. And here they are back in King's Landing together. So, yeah, there you go. Is there anything else that you want to talk about in this episode before we talk about Jamie's amazing new hand?
I think we should go to that hand.
All right, let's go to that hand. Yeah, Qyburn gives Jaime Lannister a golden hand, which produces one of my favorite gifts of all time, which is Jaime just sort of like waving with his golden hand. But you know, this is, I'm curious. I actually want to know what you think. Like, if we were to like fanfic daydream, like, what do you think happens with that hand in the final season of Game of Thrones? Like, is Jaime gonna like toss it off? Like, does it represent Lannisterism to him? Like, what is that hand? What is he gonna do with it?
That's a great question. And I had not thought about that, because I tend to think of the end of the show in terms of like who's on the throne, you know, John, Danny, that kind of stuff. I guess I hadn't. I think that a lot of people are gonna die, and I kind of think that Jaime's gonna be one of them. So maybe the hand will come into play, or like Brienne will like find it and take it home or something like that. I don't know. But you're right that it is such a significant, defining characteristic of him from season four on, that, they'll have to kind of have some closure for that thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know. Like, I kind of see it melting somewhere or something like that. Or maybe it dragging him down or holding him back in some way. And then he has to like cut loose from it. That seems to me, like, maybe that's too obvious. I don't know, but that seems to me to be like the thing that he should let go of. Or maybe like, you know, he decides not to wear it in, you know, if he doesn't make it in whatever last stand he has, he decides to leave the hand behind. Because he doesn't.
Or he like
it.
Returns it to Cersei and sort of like a sign of like, we're done.
Ooh, Jaime sends his regards with his hand. Yeah.
Or he like tosses it onto the table or something.
Anyway, yeah. I got my eye on that hand is my point. I don't know what's going to happen with it, but it feels like too symbolic, to not play into something. And I think they are leading up to Jaime having some kind of very important tragic end, in this final season. That's not a spoiler. I think there have been a lot of indicators for that. So, we'll see when it is and how it is, but, you know,
keep very Spike and Buffy.
Oh,
you know, same, similar arc.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I do have a type. It's true. All right. and then, what do we think of the John stuff in this episode of John reckoning with Rob's death and like his admission of what he did while he was, you know, being a spy and all of that?
Yeah, I feel like in some ways this is the beginning of a long period where John's just at the wall, right?
Yeah.
And so his adventuring is over for the time being, and it's back to the kind of rules and regs of what's left of the Night's Watch. And, yeah, I mean, I guess there's more to come with Rhaegreet and whatnot, but, I don't know. In some ways I am kind of glad to have him back, you know, at home, so to speak, but I also, I liked him out in the wild, with everybody.
Excellent. And then I'm just going to come back to Oberyn one last time and just say that, in addition to this really flashy intro that we get to him, he dumps a lot of exposition on us, in a way that, it winds up being really important. He talks about his sister Ilya. He talks about Rhaegar Targaryen and like all of the stuff that happens and like information about Rhaegar, what he did with his first wife and what happened to his first wife and his kids and all that is not only important to the duel that we get at the end of the season, but it's important to Jon's parentage, which we will find out, you know, many seasons hence. So
yes.
It's always fun to watch these little things take root early on. Okay, that is it for our discussion of season 4, episode 1, Two Swords. Please stay tuned. We have a great, great, long, juicy interview with weapons master Tommy Dunn, who has a lot of fun things to say about weapons he wished he had made, weapons he loved making, cameos he had, and a few little hints about season 8.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
Reboot your credit card with Apple Card, the only credit card designed for iPhone. It gives you up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase. Plus, Apple Card has no fees, not even hidden ones. Apply for Apple Card now in the Wallet app on iPhone. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City Branch. Subject to credit approval, variable APRs for Apple Card range from 19.24% to 29.49% based on creditworthiness. Rates as of February 1st, 2024. Terms and more at applecard.com.
Hello, how are you?
Don't know how I am, right?
Tommy Dunn, weapons master on Game of Thrones. Before we all break our collective hearts talking about melting down Ned Stark's sword ice into two different swords in this episode called Two Swords, let's talk about the process of making a hero sword like ice in the first.
The blades, and especially the pattern welded with ice. I mean, ice, yeah. The likes of ice, Longclaw, Widow's Wail, Old Keeper. Again, all of those were handcrafted and hand forged, all pattern welded.
Pattern welding is what you use to make those swords that you mentioned are all Valyrian.
Which is Valyrian, yes.
Yeah. So what is the process of pattern welding? How does that differ from any other kind of blade?
Well, it's a good question because pattern welding is basically the forging. It's the forging of different types of iron and steel, different carbon contents. It's a very standard form. Down to the, I think it was the second and third century, the Celts were doing it, AD. So it's quite a with the forge end of it, it's welded strips of high carbon steel. Welded together in a billet form, heated up to over 1,000 degrees, and then hammered and folded and processed and drawn. So it's a lot that goes with it, but it's something that you would always do. Learning your forge work and learning as a blacksmith or as an ironsmith, you would have this kind of world where you would be, you know, learning how to fold metal and draw it. But the only difference on this one is that you're actually using different tensiles, different carbon contents of steel. That gives you different layers and different flows of materials. And then it's how you twist it and how you fold it will create different patterns within the forge and the folding and the R&D.
So you make this beautiful, huge sword that's, you know, however many feet long.
Yeah.
And then we melt it down, by the time we get to here, disastrously. And, so you appear in this scene as the blacksmith melting down ice.
I do. I sneak out around the corner. Yeah. So you see me sneaking in from the dark. it was a good scene. We had obviously Tywin Lannister played by Charles Dance. He obviously draws it out from the from the direwolf sheath that we have. So he draws it out, then you see the beautiful blade, and then you know straight away exactly what it is. And then he walks into the forged area and presents it to me. And then obviously I start breaking it down, and I have an assistant there as well, Steve Murphy, who was actually one of my young guys that worked with me on the within the workshop in the armory. And he's a young blacksmith himself in his own right. He's a very, very good, great talent, very talented blacksmith himself. So it was funny having him as the assistant and me as the master. So it was a little bit of funniness to it. But it was a great scene. We enjoyed it. but the heat, because we used a cellar. We were down a cellar in, I can't think of it was Shane's Castle, I think it was, I'm not sure, it could have been. But we were down in one of the cellars, and my God, the heat was terrible. It was like boiling. I mean, the forge itself was a practice. They built the special effects and the art department props, and they built a practical forge, which you can obviously see there, which is it did work for what it was. Mm-hmm. And the heat of that, and then we also had special effects that had a little forge, a little blast furnace beside us also, because they were heating up the bronze that we're using, or the brass that we're using to pour into the molds, because we had to heat that up over 900 degrees thereabouts. So we had that going and the forge going, and we were choking with the heat. It was like unbelievable, and it was beautiful outdoors as well, but it was like, oh my God.
You're like, thanks, guys. Thanks for asking me to be in this.
Yeah, I know, exactly. Yeah. And then the funny thing was, originally I started off with sleeves. I had sleeves in that sequence, and it was so warm, I ripped them out of it. I don't need the 4L costume department to handle it. I just asked them to rip them out of it. Just because it was so warm. But it was a great scene. It was a very, it was a lot of practice. We had, obviously, because there's a lot of safety involved with it, dealing with the...
Yeah.
Well, the basically fire. Dealing with the crucible. Yeah. Yeah, you get the fire there. Then you got the crucible that we had to lift up and pour the crucible into the mold, creating that molten lava. So I had to make sure that it was all, you know, properly done well and safe for everybody, because the cameras are right beside us and down below looking up and looking down. And then obviously then later on special effects took over to make it like within a special effects and a visual effects feel to it as well. But it was all practical. We do a lot of it very, very practical as well. Try to do as much the camera as possible. It was an enjoyable scene. So I think we did it for, I think it was a 2-day shoot. Good fun.
It's incredible. In the books, and even in the world of the show, the idea of making Valyrian steel, or even working it as you are in the scene, is this highly trained, only one person, your character really like knows how to do it. But what you're doing here is what looks like fairly standard sort of reforging kind of thing. Was there any discussion ever of like, oh, we should do something very extreme with it to make it look much more complicated or anything like that?
I think, yes, there was. Obviously, with David and Dan, they need to try and make it as much, you know, as epic as possible. But I think we're getting to the stage. I think it was getting to the stage because the two boys were directing this. It was one of their sequences, one of their scenes that they were directing themselves. But I think it was getting to the stage where it was possibly getting out of hand. So everybody had to draw back to, you know, get the basic feel to it. And I mean, the idea of the way it looked was very good as well, because trying to put that blade in and then melt it down, get that feel that it's melted, which would be virtually impossible, but who cares? But because it was one of those things where originally I came up with thinking that I'd be able to split the blade, that we'd be able to, you know, forge the blade and split it, try and split it manually into two and then reforge it again. But I think the two boys looked at me as if I had two heads and said, nah, go away. Go away, Don. We'll do it our way. So their way was much more epic than mine. Mine, unfortunately, was practical, but theirs was epical, if that's a word.
Yeah, sure. So the resulting blades are Oathkeeper and Widow's Wail.
Widow's Wail,
yeah, which become Brienne and Joffrey and then Jaime's sword or whatever.
Yes.
But
yes.
There, another thing that I like visually in that scene is because they're two different lengths, you kind of really understand that you're getting these two different blades here. What was the decision behind making them two different lengths like that?
Well, that's a good question, because to be honest, I don't know what the real backstory was that, but obviously within the script, once we had a script, it was scripted as broken two swords, given the names Widow's Wail, Oathkeeper, and describing Widow's Wail as a smaller blade weapon than Oathkeeper. And then it worked out very well for the two characters, because obviously Jaime was a grown man and much taller, and then Joffrey was a smaller character, bigger character, but maybe a smaller person. So it actually worked out very, very well. In size-wise per frame, but I just don't know if that was personally a stroke of luck or face, one or the other. I don't know which. But
a sword for a boy and a sword for a man.
Because obviously, I mean, it was a present from Tywin.
Yeah.
So obviously, he divided it out for his two, you know, the king at the time, obviously, which is Joffrey, and then his own son Jaime, as such. So obviously, you know, he had plenty of thought and saying it.
Yeah.
Not that he did.
Not that Charles had anything to say about it.
Not that Charles had anything to do with it. He just turns up and looks great.
So this is your, if I've got my facts straight, this was your third time on screen because you were originally, you're in the original pilot that never made it to air. And then,
and then
in the pilot that we did see, Shaving the Boys in season one, episode one. So can you talk about those two cameos and how they came about?
Yeah, they were funny because I think they were just looking for Brucey's people, and somehow I fell into that category. I don't think it's something to do with my talent, because I obviously don't have much of them. But I do look like a Bruce, so it worked out very well. But the first one was obviously with the director on the pilot. Pilot is that the everyone just got on very well, and it was a small little family type of thing, and they were looking for this Bruce again that just looked left and right and tried to find young Bran looking up climbing the roof at the time, and you had me coming out like an idiot looking left, he's gone right, then looking right and he's gone left, and it's like typical soldier. So, and that never made it to air either. So that was the director just asked me would I do that, because I knew nothing about that, because then it was the poor director's assistant came up, he said, oh, thank you very much, Tommy, and I'm thinking, What for? I said, oh, yeah, no problem. He said, well, have you seen your costume yet? And I'm going, what costume? So I hadn't got a clue what you were talking about.
Oh, no.
But the second one on the first season, and that was, again, I think, again, they're looking for another Bruce, because I seen that script, and I seen the Rose wrote in there, and I'm going, hang on a second, that sounds like me. And then I knew Dave and Dan, when they were walking past my office window, looking in laughing, that it was me. So I'm sure they're just trying to stitch you up to have a bit of a laugh, you know. And then the funny thing about that one as well, because they gave me a cutthroat, and it was razor sharp. And I said, what am I going to do with this? So I had to go back into the workshop. So I'm in my apron and all dressed out and looked like a right tramp, and I'm in the workshop, and all the lads are laughing at me, my own crew, and I'm trying to blunt down this edge to make it safe before I cut the boys' throats.
Yeah, so you don't
literally,
so you don't murder Kit Harrington.
No, exactly. Don't murder Kit and poor Rob as well. It's like thinking, oh my God, this scene will be over. It'll take about 2 seconds, and that's it.
I want to let you know that I lost a Game of Thrones trivia game once, by 1 point, because I couldn't name the butcher at Winterfell, but his name is Tommy. He's named Tommy for you, right?
Exactly.
I've heard you talk before about the fact that you made Robert's Warhammer, and we never did.
We made an original one that, you know, an area that we thought we were in, and we did one anyway to have one just in case, but the boys never used it, and I always trying to get pushed it in. I wanted it for dressing, or even it was in Robert's, you know, bedroom or back room or any, but it never got aired.
Robert would keep his Warhammer in his bedroom, I'm pretty sure. So
you would think he would. Yeah, he would. He's one of those, and I kept trying to dress it in, but they always kept telling me, get out, you know, you don't need it. So it's like, there's only so many times you can try and force the weapons in there. So we never used it. Never shot on.
Do you remember when?
But obviously when we came to Gendry, we did.
Yeah. And so how closely did Gendry's Warhammer resemble the one you made for Robert?
Very, because what I wanted to do is, sorry, even though we never seen it, I actually used a lot of the imaging from that and then readapted. So a lot of the visual shape is very, very similar, that like the body and the point and the bulbous nose to it. But the shape of the wrapping, in other words, the stag wrapping and the antlers wrapping up around the side of it, was not on Robert's.
So when you got that script, when it said Gendry needs a Warhammer, you're like, oh, I've already done the work on this.
Well, right. That was already made. Yeah. It was in the closet waiting to come out.
I think I talked to Joe Dempsey a little while ago, and he told me that, you know, he was told before the season was started that he was going to have to work with a hammer, and then he trained with like a sledgehammer that he bought at, you know, the local hardware store or whatever in his backyard, just throwing that thing around, getting strong, and then he got to set, and it was like light as a feather, the one that they actually had him use.
Because we know what it's like. He fell over that night, he killed everybody. But we had choices there, obviously. But in fairness to him, he liked to carry the heavier one around most of the time. because the problem with the live ones, they get too, it's like a child swinging it, you know, it's too easy.
Yeah.
And it looks too light. So in fairness to Joe, he actually did carry the heavy one around as much as he wanted to, which is, you know, like 5 minutes here and 5 minutes there.
Sure, but he's like, I didn't build up these muscles for nothing. I can carry this here.
I don't think he did that for the forge work at all. I think it's just pure vanity. No, he's a good lad. And we did, and in that world as well, we did a bit of forge work with him. A lot of that. I'm not saying a lot, but we had a couple of days with him that we set out, and we brought him up to my lad's Steve's foundry that he has in his own place, and we did some work with him one to one, so he wouldn't feel. The worst part is feeling afraid. It's not the fact that you can do it. Anybody can hammer. You know, you can get a hammer and hammer away. It's actually just feeling positive and not feeling afraid of letting the hammer go or sparks coming out at you. You know that the sparks are going to fly down rather than fly up. So it's just a little bit of awareness, that kind of stuff. So he's not worried about, you know, that he's, you know, affected, that he'd have any sparks towards his eyes. He knows that everyone would fly away from him. So it's just more for confidence and a little bit of posture. But he was very good. I mean, he's a young lad, so he's well capable of doing it.
But the fact that we see a snippet of Gendry sort of smithing in the trailer that's already out that people have seen, I think people are really excited to see that, because obviously...
Yeah, he's got a lot of work. He's got a lot of work.
Obviously, they got a lot of forging to do. All right. And then,
a lot of forging.
And then to talk about another season one weapon that sort of made a reappearance, is this cat's paw dagger that showed up in season one with like Bran's assassination.
Oh yes.
And then it's become so important to Arya. And so my question for you is, did you know that that was going to come back when you first designed it? And if you had known, would you have made it a little differently? Knowing that it was going to be Arya's blade later.
No and no is probably my words, because I mean I enjoyed that and how it was a beautiful creation to start. Yes, it was made for, you know, a sort of, I'm saying a man size, but it was made as an assassin's dagger, so therefore it needed to be a bit more brutal, a bit more in your face, and it could kill from both ends, you know, obviously the knife as well as the hilt, either way would kill you. It was probably a little bit big. Now, we did cheat a little bit with Arya, obviously with Maisie. So we had areas where we had the weapon, and then we replicated it down to like 70% of the original size, just to help her performance. But she actually was very good with the full size one. It's just the problem was that we overlapped different directors. So one director actually was happy with 100%, and then the other director wanted the 70%. And I was like, oh my God, please don't put this scene together, you know? Like, and it's just, it was what it was, you know? It's not my call. I'm just the brutish guy that makes the stuff. So I don't have a say in that. But anyway, so we made one that was scaled down to 70% if required. And, like I said, we always had it there. But Maisie was very good. She liked the weight of the original one, because she had to do a lot of spinning and turning, as you've seen with the fight with Brienne and that.
What's it like to see these various actors like Gwendolyn or Maisie or Kit handling these weapons that you've made, and they train so hard, and I think they do an amazing job?
Yeah, I mean, from my end of it, I mean, obviously as the weapons master and for my team, it's great, because it's one of those things where you can see how your work and your blood, sweat, and tears is out and being used on camera, because I've been on so many different jobs where we've made so much and it's purely dressing in the background and never seen, never used. So for us to personally have the weapons in your face and in the front and always being used, and then obviously having highlighted weapons like your assassin's dagger or your oak keeper with his whale, and you know, all that. So everything's got a name, so people get used to where's this weapon, where's needle, where. So it really puts your work forefront to the show as well. So you feel much more involved with the shoot and much more involved with the storyline, because especially with David and Dan, if they like what you've created, And they've no hesitation of writing more of it and putting it out there a bit more or putting it in your face, especially even with the directors. A lot of directors like to maybe start on the weapon and focus off and then come off it and come on to the actors. And for us, it's unbelievable. Normally people shy away from that.
Yeah, you know how Game of Thrones fans are. They sort of pour over every single frame of something. And yeah. So I remember, I think it was last season that Jaime first wore Widow's Wail, and people yes. saw in a promo photo, they saw the hilt on his hip and they got so excited. And the same thing, I think, happened in the season 8 trailer, because you can see that Jorah is wearing Heartsbane in the trailer. And yeah, that must be, it must be fun for people to freak out over these pommels that you've made, you know? And,
well, that's it. Yeah. Exactly. You know, I mean, on their end of it, it's a full creation. It's a lot of work's gone into it. And the last thing you want is never to be seen. So at least with this, you know, the weapon's out there, you know, it's going to be seen, and you know, it's going to play an integral part in the storyline.
Yeah.
And that's the great thing about it, is that the weapons are the ones that get them out of the trouble as much as anything else. They're the ones that will save the day.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm very happy about it, and very happy about it. Same as, you know, obviously with season 8, you know, the weapons are what we talk about, you know.
The last weapon that is brought back from the beginning and is so key again here in the end is the flaming sword for Beric Dondarrion. So I was wondering if you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, again, that one was quite basic, because Beric was one of these rogue or very much down to earth and part and parcel of the feeling of the world itself. But nothing spectacular about what he did, except for the light, obviously for the light, bringing the sword flaming and everything else. But the sword itself was quite a basic sword. Nothing fantastic about it, like in appearance, quite a standard medieval feel and pommels and crosshair and handle. But obviously its power was that it ignites on as he feels, you know. So the overlap on that one was obviously with ourselves, the special effects with Sam Conway's team, was to make sure that we were able to replicate pass over some blades to them, cross guards, pommels, and then basically they created their own gas version, and then special effects created a blade that you're able to impregnate the inner blade themselves. They had a bit of wadding in there, and they had a bit of IPA or a liquid fuel that they were able to ignite, and then replicated many of them. So the boys did a good job on them with the effects, but for my end of it, there was no great dealing other than
it's a basic sword.
Quite basic.
And is it the same? Did the same thing? You know, when we see it in season 3, Kiss by Fire, is it the same setup that we see later on here in season 7?
Yes, the actual practical way it lights up is the same way all the time.
It's so spectacular. Okay, so you have forged your final weapon for Game of Thrones, the series proper.
Yeah.
Is there any character that you didn't get to make a weapon for that you really wish you could have?
Yeah, there was one. The one character who always wanted us, because she always said, "Where's mine?" Every time you're on set, was Lena.
Yeah.
With Cersei. So Cersei is always, she's a lunatic. Is that, you know, with Lena, she's always, you're always talking to her, and she's a great, great woman, and she's always going, "Where's my weapon? Where's my weapon? When do I get a weapon?" And I said, "You speak to Dave and Dan, I'll make you whatever you want." But she's always, because she'd have been great, because she's such a cool character and such a wonderful person, yeah, but she is a lunatic, you know, and she would have been great.
What kind of weapon do you think Cersei would have had? A dagger of some kind, right?
Oh, it would have been a dagger for her. Definitely something cutting, you know, something that she can just, you know, it'll appear from nowhere and just decimate people in front of her. But it would be a nice, I guess I'd do something Japanese for her, something that would be just sleek and very sharp and just very, very fast, and then back to being demure.
Yeah, right, back up the sleeve or whatever. I love that.
Oh, what I do. Yeah.
And then do you have I don't know if you're, you want to play favorites, but do you have a personal favorite weapon that you designed for the show?
Not particularly as such, because I mean, I enjoy them all, you know, because we've had so much that you never had a chance to sort of sit back and throw sugar on it and think you're the best thing ever. So you just have to make it get on and make the other 500 when you're ready. So not really. I mean, Arya Holt's the bodyguard, I really enjoyed because such a big, big axe or the big, you know, the halberd or what. You know, the boys said, "Oh, you can make me an axe," and I go, "A 6 foot axe?" I said, "Who makes a 6 foot axe?" I said, "I'll make you something, but it won't be. You can call it whatever you want to call it, but I said I won't call it an axe." But so they were very happy with it, all right. And it was funny because the first time they did see it was with Dave and Dan. I showed them in, I think we were in Croatia at the time, and I brought it over, showed them, and they went. And the first thing they looked at, they knew it was nice, but the first thing they said, "That doesn't look like an X." I'm going, "Yeah, I told you it wouldn't look like an X." But they still said, "Yeah, it's very nice."
Yeah, and because it's Dornish, it's all ornate. It's got all those jewels.
Exactly,
on it.
Exactly. Yeah. It was beautiful and it was lovely. I loved creating the shape and making that. And then obviously, you've got the brass work on it there, which is the gold, and then the wrapping and binding around the shaft itself.
And then do you do, to what extent do you do the armor as well? And to what extent is that costuming?
Not so much, no. I mean, the costume would be virtually 100% costume. It wouldn't be my, I've done before on different shows a little bit. Sometimes you'd overlap in areas where you might need maybe a greave or some part of the armor that you need to turn into a weapon, or you might create a blade for it or arrows. But on this show, no, it's in the costume and the armor, as in the metal armor, is 100% costume.
I thought I read an interview somewhere where you were talking about using snakeskin to create Oberyn Martell's armor. Did I dream that?
Oberyn, not on his breastplate. Oh. Did he have any breastplate? I'm trying to get the armor because he only had beautiful sort of silky gowns on him on Oberyn. Obviously, we did his spear.
I think for the duel, I'll have to rewatch it, but I think he has some sort of like, it's not intensive armor, but it's like practical leather sort of armor.
No.
Yeah.
I must have made that one up because maybe I like this. Okay. No. No. I can't claim that one, Michelle, killing me. No, thanks.
Oh, no. Okay. I've heard you talk before about giving tours of the arsenal that you have armory.
No, I don't give tours. I mean, the production office and HBO request can I bring people around, so I don't have a ticket booth out there, and I'm selling tickets to my own workshop in case HBO will be looking their money back off me. But yes, normally the production ring up and go, "Oh, Tommy, we have friends of Dan in." I said, "Lovely, send them over." Yeah. And then you never know who they are. They're sort of, you know, especially with Dan anyway, they're always heavy rock bands and Metallica or someone. It's funny because sometimes I don't know. I'm the worst in the world, but my son has been up here and my daughter woke up here with me as well, and they know them straight away because I think they're of the age, and I'm going, "Who are they?" So it's terrible. I just have to say hello.
Hello. You've had the Queen in there.
Besides Howard and Philip,
Is there anyone who had a particularly that you remember that had like a particularly extreme reaction to seeing all this weaponry?
There's a few because we brought so many around, and but probably no one famous as such. I mean, no one sort of famously coming in to it. That would scream and shout because everybody's like has their own. But a lot of people, a lot of the family friends or a lot of people that would come in always just loved being able to pick up the weapons, the needles and the oak keepers and Widow's Whale and Long Claw, you know, being able to feel it and, oh, you know, delight with the photographs. And but sort of none that would sort of, you know, go be screaming and shouting. I mean, in fairness, the only ones that were crazy were, I think, sort of Dave and Dan's wives are normally mad because they normally have stuff when they bring their friends in, they're always swinging the swords around trying to kill each other. So they're probably the most few lunatics that used to come in around and the friends with them. But
Amanda Pete, got it. Okay. What did it feel like for you when you made the last weapon for season 8?
Just
relief.
It's a little bit of both, because I think we sort of kept going. We made so much on season 8, it was unbelievable. But there's one creation in season 8 that is absolutely phenomenal. It'll be a showstopper. And that was great to finish. It was great to make, great to design it, and great to design it that it was able to be reverse engineered and made into two different items. But again, it's one of those things where, yeah, it was great to see it done, because then we knew we were on schedule and we knew it was made. But then knowing that, you know, we're coming to the end, and, you know, please God, you know, green light the prequel, please. It's like one of those, you know, it's like, we're going to be unemployed very soon, quick. But it was great.
Yeah. It's not a secret to say that you're working on, you and your team are working on the prequel series.
And again, I'm very grateful again to like the HBO for putting me forward for it as well. So, because obviously there's so many people out there that can do it. But it's very nice to get a shout out at this one again.
Oh, well, yeah, you've got this whole library of the world, I'm sure. I mean, and your work is so incredible. You talked before, I've heard you talk a couple times about, the daunting amount of work you had to do for season 8.
Well, we never stopped. I mean, it's like we never stopped. The certain weaponry that we have, and we never, never stopped until virtually the last week making this. It was just nonstop. But it was like, it's very hard. It's very hard to describe. This year, probably the biggest was which is siege engines, which is the larger of the weaponry. I've never made as many of them in one season. Like, we have three different items, nearly four different items that all will feature very, very heavily, as well as all the smaller items. The smaller weaponry is just by so many of them and so multiple layers of them. It just seems to be nonstop. But this season will decimate any other season or all seasons put together.
And a siege engine is like a large scale thing you use to batter down a wall or a castle door. Or something
In the world, I mean, the siege engine would be either, you know, it'd be either giant crossbows or trebuchets or catapults,
right,
or sort of larger, right, of the weapons that would be used to decimate castles, or, you know, fire projectiles or. But so many. It's very, very unusual to have so many in a season. You know, sometimes you prolong these. Yeah. You have one. Last year just absolutely decimated everybody. I mean, it was a lot of work. It was a hell of a lot of work. It was great doing it, but it was just relentless. It was relentless.
Yeah.
Very enjoyable, but it was really relentless and nonstop, and it was just like push. But that's what it is. That's the world we were in, and we're well used to it.
Well, congratulations for being on the other side of that. And then my last questions, or my last two questions for you is, you know, all these hero blades that you made, Longclaw, all of these, did the actors take any of these homes? Does Kit have Longclaw?
No.
Gwendolyn have Oathkeeper?
No.
Okay.
No, funny, because I did at the very start of the season. I obviously spoke regarding that, you know, whether cast were going to have any weaponry, and it worked out they didn't. So nobody has any cast weaponry at all. Which is surprised me, because I offered to make and create if required
replicas.
Officially, no, nobody has any.
Okay. And then as for you,
and I have none either. I can tell you that.
You have none either. Did you grab anything else, anything non-pointed as memorabilia from the show?
No. The only thing I took was the Queen's money, that's all. But other than that,
right,
I couldn't buy my own stuff. No. I'm not one of these people that hoards. Unfortunately, I don't hoard. Yeah, if I hoarded every weapon from every show I made, I think my walls would fall down. There'd be nothing left of them.
I was just thinking of like what you might take, and I was like, well, how cool that there's a god named the Smith. Like, I would be tempted to take if there was some sort of statue made for the Smith god. If I were you, I'd be tempted to take it. But
yeah, yeah.
Money will do.
I haven't seen one yet. And I don't think props would appreciate me taking that either. So I think either way, I couldn't get away with it if I wanted it.
All right. Well, thank you so much again for your time. I really, really appreciate it.
Not at all. Absolute pleasure.
All right. Well, that is it for Two Swords. Richard, until we return, where can people find you?
Some fans are having me over for dinner.
You can find Richard tweeting his last tweets on Rylos as he heads over to the fence house. You can find me on Joe Wrote This. Just think about that hand. That's what I will be doing. I'll think about Jamie's hand. Next time we will be talking about season 4, episode 8, The Mountain of the Viper. So basically we're bookending our first Oberyn episode and our last Oberyn episode.
that's kind of cruel. This great new character. Now he's dead.
Now he's gone.
Horribly dead.
It's kind of amazing that he only lasted 7 episodes of the show and he still looms large. As an like icon. An icon. All right. We will see you guys next time.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Oh. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.